Good morning and welcome to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. It's the weekly program about health, nutrition, and lifestyle in general. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Tim Henney. Today in the program, Tama Keeves joins us. Tama graduated with honors from Harvard Law School, then found she was miserable working at a prestigious law firm and risked it all to become a visionary career catalyst, motivational speaker, life coach, and a best-selling author. She joins us to discuss her new book, Thriving Through Uncertainty.
I am so looking forward to that conversation. And do you know why?
Are you feeling a little uncertain?
Well, I am not good with uncertainty, even though there's a big part of me that seeks uncertainty and risk. But at the same time, it kind of paralyzes me. So I think this is going to be a really great conversation.
I think you should make a New Year's resolution that has to do with uncertainty. Embracing the uncertain.
Oh, but I have so many others. Well, let's talk about that a little bit later. How about that? And then our second guest is, well, it's an extraordinary story of survival and thriving through uncertainty by one family during the Holocaust. It's a granddaughter who writes of the journey of her family. Georgia Hunter joins us in the second half to talk about her book, We Were the Lucky Ones. This is The Mountain Life. Stay with us. We'll be back after these words from our underwriters.
Whitney Wall here from Park City Mountain and KPCW's sponsor. Park City Mountain's Epic Promise recently committed to a net zero footprint by 2030. The environment is our business. By 2030, we commit to zero net emissions, zero waste to the landfill, and a zero net operating impact to forests and habitat. More information at epicpromise.com.
This is Dr. Phil Davidson of Davidson Orthopedics, Park City resident and KPCW fan. Our practice offers solutions for knee and shoulder problems to enjoy the active Park City lifestyle. More information is available on our website at davidsonorthopedics.com.
G'day, this is Ashley from Campus Coffee, happy to sponsor programming on KPCW. We can't wait to serve the Park City locals this winter. We're excited by our breakfast and lunch menu to complement our espresso drinks. Campos Coffee is open daily at the base of Park City Mountain Resort, up the stairs from the ice rink next to the Adirondack chairs. CamposCoffee.com.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with my co-host, Tim Henney. And Happy New Year, by the way. I don't know if I said that yet.
You didn't say it on air, so thank you.
You've already begun hassling me about my New Year's resolutions.
And why not?
And why not? Because
That's my New Year's resolution, get an early start on the hassling.
Oh, good. Okay, well, let's see, to stay with the old job or make a leap of faith to a new one, uncertainty can be paralyzing. Uncertainty, our next guest, Tama Keeves, says, can drain or overwhelm. But she tells a different story, and she says it's time that we start doing the same. Start telling a new story and start reminding yourself that it's safer to go in the direction of your desires. Where you feel moved, you can move mountains. Even though security might seem secure, in fact, passion is actually security, she says. It can be difficult to see which path to take, and in the midst of change or transition, Tama's new book is called Thriving Through Uncertainty, and it'll be out later this week. It shows the path is already within you, and it's more fulfilling than you imagine. We're happy to welcome Tama Keeves back to The Mountain Life, but we don't have her on the air just yet.
As soon as she calls. She is calling.
Okay. And we'll take a quick underwriting break and then welcome Tama Keeves back on The Mountain Life. Stay with us.
This is J.C. Coleman, manager of the Park City branch of Fairway Independent Mortgage, helping out KPCW. Celebrating 20 years, the Fairway Independent Mortgage team provides lending options for jumbo, conventional, condo, hotel financing, and more for the Park City home buyer, located at 1245 Deer Valley Drive. Details at lendtopc.com, NMLS number 2289.
And Tama Keeves, with her new book, Thriving Through Uncertainty, joins us now. Good morning to you, Tama.
I'm so glad to be here. Thank you.
Well, it's great to have you back. And we talked to you, what was it, about 4 years ago, I think, that you came out with your last book. And it was so fun to talk to you then. So we're glad that you...
I'm delighted. Thank you. I love talking about my book. So, yeah.
Good. Well, even though it was a very long time ago in your life, it's still so pertinent. And it's sort of the message that you're carrying forth with...
Yes.
With Thriving Through Uncertainty. So tell us about how, you know, you had this very secure, very successful career as a Harvard-educated lawyer, but you were miserable. So tell us how you jumped
into uncertainty. It's the basis of all my books, and it's the basis of all my work, and certainly it's the basis of this new book, Thriving Through Uncertainty, because I think, like many people, I was striving for certainty and security and what I thought would bring that, and I found myself incredibly unhappy and incredibly miserable because, you know, when I was younger, I knew what I wanted to do. When I was younger, I'd always wanted to be a writer, but I grew up in Brooklyn, New York, to an Orthodox Jewish family, and, you know, I got, you're going to write? You are going to starve, you're going to write. And that was basically the go for your dreams talk. And so I just immediately thought, oh, well, you can't have what you want in this life. So I went after security, or quote, certainty. And I went to law school, got accepted to Harvard Law School, graduated with honors. I was on partnership track for a major law firm. And I just started feeling so empty and so meaningless, and just this feeling like, God, there's got to be something more. There's got to be something else. And thank God a friend of mine just said, you know, think about it. If you've been this successful doing something you don't even love, what could you do with what you love? So that's what began this whole journey for me, and it's one of the reasons that I write about uncertainty, because sometimes it's the pursuit of certainty that kills people, or they back off from uncertainty or what they really, really want. And I don't want them to miss their incredible lives, whether it's in relationship or health or money or career, because, again, listening to those brilliant instincts is going to take you all the way.
Well, you know, I think throughout our lives, and certainly when we're sort of, you know, in high school and going on to pursue higher education, we're given a bunch of mixed messages, and we keep reiterating and telling ourselves those mixed messages throughout our whole lives. And it starts with, I remember this book, you know, do what you love, the money will follow. Mm-hmm, and then mm-hmm. I went and did what I loved, which was to become a ski bum in Park City. Well, here I am.
Look at you.
Look at me. But I remember this time in my 20s of feeling incredibly lost, because I was realizing that doing what I was passionate about really wasn't what I was passionate about, because the money didn't follow, as it turned out. And so I think throughout our lives, we're like, we want to go towards our passion, but it's scary because it many times is not secure. There's no stability in it, and it's nothing but uncertain. And so how can you rectify this for us?
In 2 seconds or less, right?
No. Yeah.
Rectify this whole problem of the universe in 2 seconds. You know, I think that what I would say is that going for your passion on some level is always secure. There is some kind of security in it. First of all, I think, like in your situation, maybe you just needed to do that to know. You would have spent your whole life regretting or wondering, what if I'd done it? What if I'd done it? What if I'd tried it? There are many people, you know, for myself, in becoming a writer, no, there wasn't the traditional security, and there wasn't the, you know, easy paycheck kind of thing. But some of it, in some situations like that one, for me anyways, was a matter of learning how to stay with it or face it, because our minds get in the way all the time. It's why I wrote this book, is that it's that self-talk that's constantly getting in the way, that's telling you you're going to fail, you're not going to make it, mm-hmm. and or that you need money to be happy. You know, yes, you need money to eat maybe, but again, it's such a relative choice, right? So I deeply believe that when someone's truly going for their passion, their real passion, and I'm not saying a diversion or a hobby, but some real passion, at least for myself and for the clients I've worked with, you tap these other capacities, you tap these other strengths, you tap this other brilliance you might not have known was there. And that's, you know, that's what I don't want people to miss, is because they're so afraid of not having a guarantee in life. And yet I know that if someone's listening to what's truly right for them, there is a guarantee. There's something that unfolds. There's something that you feel, you know, you ask any creative person or any entrepreneur or anybody who's doing their right life in some ways, anybody who's fallen in love with the right person, in that moment, they know what they know what they know. There is a security and a strength like nothing else.
Right.
And again, it's a matter of how do you use your mind constantly and consistently to talk yourself out of fears.
So this is a little bit off track, Tama, but it's on track. But I just have to mention this. I don't know if you're familiar with Edward Sharpe and the Magnetic Zeros, but he has a song. That group has a song. It's very popular. So if you YouTubed it or Google it, I would recommend you YouTube it and watch it and our listeners. And it's called Man on Fire. And the theme of the song is, everybody wants certainty. And he goes through the categories. Everybody wants certain love. Everybody wants certain career. But there is no certainty. Nothing's
right
guaranteed.
On.
And it's, as I said, it was quite popular a few years ago and has a lot of views and all that kind of thing. But that's kind of cool.
I love that.
Yeah.
I love that. And that actually was one of the main reasons I wrote Thriving Through Uncertainty, is because exactly what you just said, everybody is putting off their lives secretly. We're all doing it. I do it. You know, like, when I get there, I'll be okay. And if this one thing happens, then it'll be all right. If I could just get through this, I'll be okay. And we're all putting our lives off for someday. We're always trying to get there, wherever there is. And I want to help people get here. I want to help people arrive in their life right now, where they are, and to awaken to that strength and that joy and possibility right here. Because, you know, like you just said, there is no external certainty. There never is. Everything is going to shift. But if you learn how to use your mind and you learn how to use your resources to face every single day in a new way, there's nothing. I think that's why we're here.
Well, and you mentioned a minute ago, you know, we fall prey to our self-talk to some degree. But isn't the self-talk actually being fed by those externalities? The marketing, the marketers of the world have figured out what scares us, how to frighten us, how to drive us. And it's very egocentrically focused. You know, if you don't have this size house, you're a failure. If you haven't achieved this in your career, you're a failure. And what do you do to rectify that?
If your thighs don't look like hers, you're a failure.
Right. And so you do these very egocentrically focused activities to try to address those things. And so how do you get to the, you know, through the self-talk into the more societal talk and infuse heart and soul? Isn't that what you're talking about? Finding
that's
a space
exactly
of heart
what
and
I'm
soul?
Talking about. That's exactly what I'm talking about. And you nailed it, because I think most of our negative self-talk has come from, you know, either school, society, parents, and certainly the media, because as you said, the media, you know, is designed a lot of times to make you feel fearful, or to make you feel insecure, or to make you feel like you're not okay. And if you would just buy that one new car, you'd be much better off. And that's why, again, that self-talk gets into, you know, what we were getting before about, you know, do what you love and the money will follow, you know, is that, again, I work with primarily leaders and artists and entrepreneurs and people who are really shifting in their lives. And a lot of the talk that comes up is, you know, what is success, right? What is success? Because they're on fire in their lives, and things are working, and they're finally doing what they came here to do. But then they'll do exactly what you said, of starting to compare themselves to, yeah, but I don't have $1 million, or I don't have this, you know, a second home, or I don't have a whatever. And I think for so many of us, it's redefining, you know, it's redefining what success is, what security is. And again, I know that when you're on fire in your life, when you're on fire and how you're being a parent and whatever it is, in that moment, there's no insecurity. In that moment, there's no lack. And there's that moment. That's what we really want. We want that experience of being alive. And again, I think we have all these material things that we think we need. So again, it's such a personal choice, and I'm not against buying material things or having a nice car. It's just I want somebody to do what's truly right for them and to listen to their own instincts and their own voice instead of somebody else's.
So in this redefinition of what we want and redefinition of the negative self-talk into positive self-talk and the self-judgment, you know, I would imagine that you come across people who, you know, they just want that guarantee before they take the next step. And is there something that you give them that can feel like a guarantee? I mean, I know I hear that you're saying that when you take the step that you're supposed to be taking, when you're finding going towards your passion, it feels secure. But do some of us need that little, like I'm thinking of something as silly as, you know, okay, just keep putting money in your 401k. But over on this side, you know, we're going to totally redefine. You know what I mean? Like it gives them a little anchor
absolutely.
Or something.
Absolutely. You know, again, this is such a personalized journey. That's, you know, it's such a personalized chemistry. What I'm really teaching people to do is listen to their own inner instincts. And everybody's different, and their level of risk is different, and the level of what they're meant to do is different. And so I agree with you. Anything that helps you feel a little safer is a wonderful thing. I am no bungee jumper. You know,
yeah.
I am a neurotic, crazy person. I am terrified of most things. So I have to, you know, this whole book is my own self-talk of giving myself safety. But I think the main thing that I would want for somebody is to take a tiny little step, to make it really simple to take a tiny little step. Because if you take that step, it's going to, you know, if you take that step, it changes your brain chemistry. It changes the way you think. It changes the way you orient. And that's going to give you a guarantee that nothing I could say would do. You know, like if you take a step in the right direction, you do anything you've really wanted to do or step towards it, it's going to change everything. You're going to start having momentum in the right direction. And that, to me, is the guarantee.
So then describe how it changes our brain chemistry in a way that we will recognize. You know, you talk about having clarity and having security. How will we recognize it? I think that's where people don't know if they can, you know, get on the train of embracing insecurity.
You know, so again, you know, one of the best ways that people get on the train, and it's not pretty, but it's true. You know, one of the best ways that most of us do this is through pain. You know, myself, I am no natural born risk taker. You know, I'm like totally risk averse, you know, of I want safety just like everybody else. And for me, you know, even my big career change, it was like, it came through pain. It didn't even come through, oh, yes, it's the right thing to do. I'll go do that. It was just that life will support you that way. If you're not doing the right thing, it will get more painful. And so for me, it wasn't even so much about having courage, but there was desperation, right? There was just like you start feeling unhappier and unhappier and unhappier, and then you find like, okay, I have nothing to lose at this point. You know, I'll take a step. So I think you'll either take a step because you are motivated to do that and you're curious and you feel good and you have support, or life will get painful and it will hurt, and then you will take a step. But either way, you will get there.
So Tam, I'm going to ask you to do like a little assessment of the human condition and where we are, because what I hear you explaining to me explains a lot of kind of what we experience day in and day out, and that is people are not particularly happy by and large deep down at some fundamental level. You know, they aren't connecting their heart and soul to what they do, and they are tolerating what they do, and they're living through it, thinking that if they do A, then they'll get to B, and then C will happen.
Yeah.
And they go through, you know, they pass through life and wake up one day and have their midlife crisis, and et cetera, et cetera. But that would explain why a lot of, I don't know, a lot of what's going on right now at a national political level and a global level with, you know, backlashes to people who feel disenfranchised. That's another term for grumpy, right? I mean, their jobs have gone away and they're looking to blame people and all that kind of thing.
Yes. You know, and you're absolutely true. And one of the things that I really talk a lot about in Thriving Through Uncertainty is just really making the decision of taking responsibility in your life, you know, taking responsibility for what you're feeling, what you're thinking. It's so easy to blame external circumstances. And I'm not saying external circumstances aren't challenging. But again, you have the choice of who you decide to be in this lifetime, what you choose to think, and how you choose to respond. And one of my main points in the book is that your response to your life is your life. It's not so much what's happening, but it's your response to your life that is your life. And so it's really learning, because it's a lot of my own personal experience. It's like I really had to learn how to be kinder with myself and how to be encouraging with myself and how to have that self-talk that was positive. Or, you know, I'm a coach for a living, and it's like I had to learn how to coach me, you know, how to be gentle and kind and yet fierce and take a tiny little step in the right direction and take another tiny little step in the right direction, because, you know, it will hook you. The right direction is the right direction. When you go towards something that's really, truly yours, your destiny, it's going to pull you. It's going to feel good. And so, again, so much of this really comes down to the relationship that you're having with yourself. And what, and it's taking responsibility for that. It's making the decision that, you know what, my life is my life, and I want to have peace and freedom, and I can have it right here no matter what's going on. No matter what's going on externally, I can start being a different storyteller to myself. I can start having different, choosing different ways to think, choosing different ways to show up. And I promise you, I know that when you start doing that, everything changes.
The book is Thriving Through Uncertainty, and Baby Steps. I love that. Tama Keeves, we're so glad you could join us again on The Mountain Live. Thank you.
I'm so grateful, and I hope people join me on my website at tamakeeves.com. I have all kinds of free resources and classes and my tour, and I'd love to meet some of you. And I'm so grateful that you're doing this show, and I just really hope that people listen to the dreams that are inside them, because it's not frivolous. It's imperative. Thank you.
Oh, I love it. Thanks.
Yeah.
It's not frivolous. It's imperative.
Good
I like
word.
That.
Imperative.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And we could have spoken with her longer. She had another interview, but I did want to talk to her. I've been reading a lot on what's known as the gig economy or portfolio careers, where you've got your career, but your baby step that you're taking are these little side hustles that you're recognizing, you know, it's not enough for me just to do this one thing that is certain and is secure here, where it, you know, I need these other things, and to develop these other portfolios that you can branch out into, and that may be your hobbies or your passions, and somehow it, you know, they all kind of come back and layer upon each other to make that original thing that you're doing. Well, either to make you realize about yourself that you need to get out of the original thing,
right?
Or it enhances it, and it makes it better, so it makes it
a little more soulful.
A little more soulful. I was going to say tolerable. I knew that was not the right word. Yeah. Soulful.
Well, that is kind of what we hear this over and over and over again, mm-hmm, about heart and soul in conflict and maybe even competition with how society defines success and kind of the free market capitalist version of success, which we're very familiar with. And even here in this community, we experience it all the time. Mm. I mean, we want a vibrant, robust business community, and yet we feel that the heart and soul of the community is somehow at risk, and those two are connected.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we have it in our personal lives.
That's right.
My daughter, you know, Thea, wonderful Thea, is getting an MFA at the University of Minnesota. And she's in her second year of a 3-year program, and she is in crisis because she doesn't see how this translates into a career that she can She can sustain herself. She can be self-sustaining.
Yeah.
And the odds of that happening, but the odds of, you know, Thea's always been into things where the odds didn't necessarily favor her, and they have worked out wonderfully in her favor, like even getting into this MFA program. But at the same time, that's a real concern. And she's almost 30 years old. She turns 30 in February. So here she is, having lived this spectacular life by anybody's, you know, standards or qualifications or description, I think, except for herself. And she's going... For the first time that I see this kid who has always been full of self-confidence and didn't care about where it went in the future and how it translated to career, that's what she's in chaos about now at age 29, almost 30.
Aren't they supposed to in those MFA programs? Isn't it supposed to be focused on how to get a job with this particular master's degree?
I mean, it is a step in that direction, but she's not seeing kind of the path where it's clear for her. So it's creating some chaos.
I think she needs to read Tama Keith's book.
And listen to Man on Fire.
Yeah.
Over and over.
Thriving Through Uncertainty. And TamaKeeves.com. She does have a lot of great information on this website. It's T-A-M-A, Tama Keeves, K-I-E-V-E-S.com. And love the take. And I remember when we spoke with her a couple of years ago, loved that take as well. So it's worked for her. It can work for all of us. Stay with us. We'll be back after these words from our underwriters.
Matt here from San Francisco Design. Since the start of our business in 1990, we have been supporting KPCW. We offer home decor for Park City and Salt Lake and feature modern furnishings from around the world. Whether you're looking to furnish an entire home or just redecorating a single room, we can help with our in-house design team. Located on Bonanza Drive and on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
Programming for KPCW is sponsored in part by Mark Wangsgard and Jim Doilney of Retail at New Park, part of the development team of New Park Town Center and co-owners of the New Park Sun Plaza, location of many Park City community events.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, healthy living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with Tim Henney. Now we go to Poland on the eve of World War II and to a story of a Jewish family ripped away from each other at the start of the German and Russian occupation of Poland and their extraordinary journey back to each other. Our next guest, Georgia Hunter, did not know that her family was made up of Holocaust survivors, not until she was 14 years old. Once she found out, she went on a quest to uncover her family's story for herself and to eventually retrace their journey ultimately back together. And now she's written a book about it. It's called We Were the Lucky Ones. She joins us now. Georgia Hunter, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thank you, Lynn. Thanks for having me.
Well, this is an extraordinary story just to hear about how you did not know your family's history until you were about 14, and then you knew very little about it. Why was that?
I did. Yeah. You know, we talk about that a lot. And I think my grandfather, Addy, who you meet in chapter one, like many survivors, chose once he kind of made it, once he made it to the States, it was unsafe territory, and he started a family, and he got his business up and running. He just put that piece of him behind him. He was a forward-thinking guy, and he, you know, he had seen what being Polish and Jewish could have, should have done for his family, and decided not to dwell on it. Now, interestingly, some of his other siblings did retain their Jewish heritage and did talk a little bit more about it. And when my mother was growing up, he would travel back to Brazil, where he had brothers, and he'd celebrate Passovers with him, but he wouldn't tell the family that that's what he was doing. So he kept it up in sort of his own personal way, but it just wasn't a piece of our dialogue. And I was so young, I was an only child, and you know, he was pretty sick by the time I was about 11 or 12. Mm-hmm. That just wasn't part of our conversations, interestingly.
Yeah, very interesting. I have often mused about this theory that we carry victimization in our DNA. And I think that that's very interesting. Your grandfather's approach may have been sort of wrapped up somewhat in that, where he didn't want to continue living through his victimization. I don't know. What do you think about that?
I've thought about that a lot too, and you know, I've read about that, and I think that could be a piece of it. I think, you know, his choice to kind of disassociate it probably was equal parts for himself as well as for future generations. And you know, I don't know. I'd like to. I wonder all the time if I could have, you know, asked him about it. And I don't think it was some big secret. I don't think he would have said, "Oh no, I'm not talking about it." I think he would have opened up. I just think it wasn't, the weight of it wasn't something he wanted to carry with him. And, you know, when he did talk about the little pieces that he, you know, would tell my mom and my uncle and my aunt about, they were told almost anecdotally, you know, with laughter. And then, can you believe it? I ended up in the music salon of this ship full of refugees, and we'd gather around the piano every night. And this is when he's escaping France for Brazil. And a lot of the stories were actually passed down to me with that levity. And I wonder if that's how the, you know, my grandfather's generation told them, as a way of, you know, not harboring, not holding on to the horrificness of it,
right,
but rather trying to remember the pieces of it that got them through, like the fact that my grandfather was still making music throughout the war, like the fact that there were romances, there were babies being born. And that was one of the things that amazed me in my research, is I thought it would just be one horrific event after another, which it was, but it was interspersed with these moments of levity and of love and of this family bond. I just felt it so much when I...
Oops. Well, she was right in the middle of a great thought. Hopefully she'll give us a call right back, and we'll just take a little underwriting break. Sounds like someone hit the disconnect button. We'll be right back. This is The Mountain Life. Stay with us.
For adventurers on a budget, the Utah Olympic Park offers a host of activities at no charge. Admission and parking are always free. Start with a tour of the Alf Engen Ski Museum and the Eccles 2002 Winter Games Museum. Best of all, come support athletes from all over the world who train at the park. Open daily from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. Details available at utaholympiclegacy.org.
Utah Olympic Park is a nonprofit organization dedicated to providing winter sport and recreation opportunities, and a KPCW supporter.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with Tim Henney. We were just speaking with Georgia Hunter. Her book is called We Were the Lucky Ones. Unfortunately, somehow she got cut off, and so we're hoping to get reconnected to her here. But a fascinating book. Her family in 1939 is when they are first compromised, residents of Poland. Germany invades Poland at that time, and the family sort of, beginning in 1939 and in subsequent years, scatters literally across the globe, as she said, to Brazil, eventually to the United States. And it's a very interesting story, and she has just come out with a paperback version of this book, which, curiously, she presents as a novel. And we hope to get her back on the line so we can talk about that.
Yes, we do. There she is.
And here she is. Georgia, we have you back.
I'm back. Sorry, I have no idea what happened.
I don't know either. But, well, we were just talking a little bit amongst ourselves, waiting for you to get back on, to talk about, maybe before we go any further, to talk about how you created a novel out of this story. And it's very, you know, it follows the history of your family, but there were certain things that you wanted to do that involved fiction. And so could you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. Yeah, I know. I thought actually long and hard about
writing it as nonfiction because I'd spent so long researching it. I think it was 9 years from start to finish. And and every narrative, all the storylines of who was where and when is absolutely based on the truth and uncovered in my research. But what I found in the end and in my early drafts, it was, everything kind of came together in the shape of a timeline first. And then I realized, okay, well, I could leave it at that, but I really want to put it into a format that's readable, something people can relate to. So I want to turn it into a book, and how do I do that? So and that was when I made the decision that even though I had the bones of the story, I felt like I was missing the connective tissue. So like the emotional piece of it, what were they thinking, what were they feeling? So unfortunately, I wasn't able to interview my grandfather and his siblings firsthand. So that's when I kind of decided to allow myself the creative license to fictionalize and to imagine those details and try to make the story feel very human, very less black and white, more colorful, like see it as they were seeing it, put readers in their shoes. And I don't know, I hope that in the end, by allowing myself to fictionalize it, it might have even brought the story closer to the truth.
And Georgia, I'm wondering about the title, We Were the Lucky Ones. And does that, is that looking back at those who were not the lucky ones? Oh.
Darn. Well, let's try it again. I'm not sure what's going on, if it's our line or hers. And we'll take a quick underwriting break. We'll be back. You gotta love live radio. It's the Mountain Life.
Valley Behavioral Health is a local nonprofit and proud supporter of KPCW. We are your community behavioral health center and provide a broad range of services, including individual, family, couples, and group therapy for mental health and substance abuse. We serve all ages in all of Summit County. Please check out our website at valleycares.com or 649-8347 for more information.
And welcome back to The Mountain Life. Oh, it's such an interesting conversation. We don't know if it's our phone line or hers that is dropping the call from Georgia Hunter. But if we do get her back on, we'll try to. Here she is. Here she is one more time. Georgia, I don't know if this is our phone line or yours, but it's such an interesting conversation. We don't want to let it go.
I know. So, I hate that I keep losing you.
So,
So, Georgia, about the title, we were the lucky ones. We were the lucky ones. Does that reference those who were not the lucky ones, who were left behind? Because it looks like, you know, your story, as you said, Addie's telling it with some humor and anecdotally. And it's not something that seems to be infused with a great amount of trauma. And as you said, that there's probably a reason for that. He's trying to leave that behind and move forward and not put it into the DNA of the family, as Lynn mentioned. But at the same time, there were those who were not the lucky ones. And is the title part of a reference towards those and honoring those who didn't make it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I thought a lot about how to write this book in a way that would pay respect to the majority. And, you know, my family was somewhat of a statistical anomaly, and that's not something that you necessarily want to shout from the rooftop. So I was very conscious of that in my writing and in the way I talk about it. And I included scenes from the ghetto that were, you know, that I hadn't been told firsthand, but that I read about in other firsthand accounts, because I really wanted to make sure readers understood that, yes, while my family was able to skirt the concentration camps, this was what was going on around them. And it was horrific. And yes, they were able to hold on to some of their semblances of their old lives here and there. But it was definitely the darkest chapter of their lives. So for sure, the title pays respect to those who were not so lucky. And it's also, interestingly, was actually verbatim, came from my great aunt Felicia, who I think I mentioned was a year old at the start of the war. And so she was she was there at that family reunion in the year 2000, and when we were sitting around and everyone was telling stories, and at the end of the night, she spoke up and said, you know, looked around and said, you know, we really shouldn't be here. It's almost a miracle that we're all here today. We were the lucky ones. And so obviously that sentiment stuck with me.
That's a beautiful place to get the title from. And just that fact that you were sitting around hearing these stories and the title of what would become your book came out of that session of hearing these oral stories. I'm curious about the research that you did and how important is the oral aspect, and or was there enough written documentation for you to go back and reconstruct the events in the way that you needed to do so?
It was a combination of both. I'd say probably more oral history than outside research. Everybody had this kind of vague storyline of how their father or mother or parents managed to survive. So what I would do is I would take what I found in my interviews, that oral history, and then I'd try to back it up with the outside research. So if I knew, for example, that the one brother was sent to Siberia, I'd track down records from that time and place. And that actually, amazingly, I was even able to find a handwritten account of my great uncle Genix, who spent a year in the gulag with his wife and his son who was born there, about, you know, exactly why he was arrested in Poland, why and when he was sent off to Siberia, how long it took to get there, the name of the camp, what they were doing there, why they were released. And then I had a couple relatives that joined the Polish army, which fell under the wing of the British army, and they kept immaculate records, so I had that. So I basically kind of took the bones of the story and then tried to back it up with the outside research, pepper in those details that I was able to find through digitalized records and through these, you know, queries that I would write. And sometimes it would take, I'd hire a translator, I'd write some, just, you know, some memorial center in Moscow, and then sometimes it would be like 11 months later, I'd get a letter in the mail, and there might be one name and one date, but I'd pop that into my timeline and get really excited about it, and then on to the next one. It was really a combination of oral and outside research.
And I'm wondering, where did this, I mean, I know where this book came from. It came from your history and your family's history, but are you a novelist, a writer? What kind of inspired you to take this on as a project and create this narrative that is now out in paperback?
You know, this came from such a personal place. I guess going into it, I call myself a family historian, or I was attempting to be. I kind of had my detective hat on and was just asking a lot of questions and doing a lot of digging. I never imagined, to be honest, that it would turn into what it has today and find itself in the hands of so many readers. But because I really set off to write it or to research this piece of my history for the family, for the people who lived through it, and then for my kids and their kids and so on. So that's where it all began. I have a career as a copywriter, so I write, in marketing materials, that kind of thing, for travel companies, which has helped me in my writing of, like, how I set a scene, maybe, and how I describe settings. But this is definitely a first-time project for me, this first novel of mine.
It's kind of interesting to tie it to our previous interview. In the first half of the hour was with Tama Keeves, and her book is called Thriving Through Uncertainty. And it's about, you know, like following your passion and reaching out to, whether it is in this hobby that you somehow were driven and compelled to uncover over 9 years, you followed that. And her argument is that uncertainty, going towards what you're passionate about, is actually quite secure. And when you're there, you know it, you know that this is the step that you need to take. And you must have felt that way. I mean, researching this for 9 years, you're not just a family historian. There was something in this that propelled you forward.
Oh, I know. I guess it was just, it was very innate. You know, it was like, I knew I had to do it, and it was only a matter of time. And I guess that is a bit unique. If it was somebody else's story, I don't know if I would have felt as driven, but I feel like there was never am I going to finish this, or am I going to finally put the last piece of the puzzle together. It's when am I going to do it? You know, it's just, something I knew I had to do. But I like that the idea that even if there's an uncertainty to it, I wasn't sure how it would all come together, but I knew it would somehow, some way, because I was so passionate about it. Like, it was just piece of me, you know, it was just something I had to do.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, the book is We Were the Lucky Ones. Our guest is Georgia Hunter. And Georgia, you know, I have the timeline sitting in front of me, but you must have a pretty good, like, minute or two explanation of sort of where your family went and how they got spread out all over the globe. You talked a little bit about Siberia and we've talked about Brazil, but can you go from the source where you lived and then what happened?
From where they were raised in Poland.
Yes.
You mean? Mm-hmm. Or my personal travels and my research.
Oh, sorry. No, your family's living in Poland. It's 1939,
yeah.
And where did they go from there?
So my grandfather was living in Toulouse in France, and he would frequent the jazz clubs in Paris. And the story has it, he got a letter one day from his mother saying, "I don't think it's safe for you to return home for Passover this year." And sure enough, he found himself stuck. And had a short stint in the Polish column of the French army, and then apparently forged his own demobilization papers when he realized he needed to get out, and found a visa, which was actually issued illegally, I learned, through an ambassador named Sazadantis, and he got on a boat that was meant to take him to Brazil, but that ended up getting delayed in both Dakar and in Casablanca. So he found himself in Casablanca with an expired visa, but I won't give too much away. He eventually makes his way to South America. And then the rest of the family in Poland, so when I first set off in my research, I figured, okay, well, I'll have my grandfather's piece and then I'll have the family in Poland. But I quickly realized that each of their stories were going to be different. They all had their individual path to survival. So one brother ended up in Siberia for a year before being granted amnesty on the condition that he fight for Stalin. When Stalin decided he was going to be, you know, Hitler turned his back on Stalin. Stalin's now part of the Allies. So, okay, all those Polish prisoners in my gulag, you are released, but you will fight for me. So, again, my great-uncle really had no other choice but to join the army, and it took almost a year for him to reach Persia, cross the Caspian Sea, join the army, and then he fought in the Italian campaign. Actually, he was in northern Africa and then fought in the Italian campaign, and probably the most famous battle is the Battle of Monte Cassino. That was his piece. Another brother ended up in Lvov. The mother-daughter sister, my grandfather's sister Mila and her daughter were in the ghetto in Rodom, and they actually had to figure out how to escape the ghetto, again, without giving too much away. But once they finally managed to get out, they lived with false IDs in Warsaw. Their paths took them all over Poland, and then finally through what was then Czechoslovakia, Austria, and down the coast of Italy along the Adriatic coast. So when I went down, when I went to Europe to do my traveling in their footsteps, that's the path that I took. I kind of followed in their footsteps throughout Eastern Europe, which was also quite moving.
Georgia, I'm wondering what your intention was for your readers, because I know that from your standpoint, just revealing this amazing family history that's a compelling novel and a compelling story, was that enough for your readers, for you, to provide that to them? Or did you have a different intention and hope for when they finished your book, they'd walk away with something else?
It was certainly the story that I felt like needed to be told for the story's sake, because it really, what they endured and how they managed to survive feels almost unbelievable at times. But I think more so, I really wanted to tell their story in a way that made this chapter in history, which
uh-oh,
feel ancient.
There we go. There, we lost you for about 3 seconds.
But, okay.
So back up 5 seconds.
Okay. So I wanted to tell their story, which takes place in this chapter of history, which will soon feel ancient, sadly, in which, you know, in many people's minds is with our perspective we have now, almost unfathomable, right, with the statistics that we know. I wanted to tell it in a very human way. So I hope that maybe readers might take away a personal story. So they may learn about what was going on from a global perspective and ask about where the family was. You know, they were really traveling across continents trying to stay one step ahead and survive. So they kind of get this global perspective and historical perspective about what was going on at the time, but told through one family's lens. So in a very human way that my hope will make the story feel, you know, that time in history feel more relevant and feel more personal.
And the feedback that you get from your readers, because now with a book that's very successful, it's been on the market for a while, you just came out with the paperback. Is there anything surprising that you hear from readers?
Oh, I'm just, it's very surreal to know that my very personal family history is in the hands of so many readers. I still have to pinch myself I knew my family would buy a copy. I didn't realize so many people around the world now. It's been published in all different languages and so many people. I'm blown away by the response it's gotten, how it's resonating. And people seem to people seem to be moved by different aspects of it. So I might get a note to my Facebook page or to my email through my website about, oh my gosh, I had family. My family was from Rodham, and do you know how I can research their history? Do you have any advice? Or my family had the last name Kirk too. Or even just my grandfather was a survivor and never talked about it. Or I have grandparents who are survivors, and now I'm going to ask them about it. You know, so everybody's kind of taking something different away, which I think is so neat, it makes me so happy to know that it's resonating and that people are inspired to ask questions, maybe research their own ancestry, or maybe even just think about that time in history and what it might mean to them personally.
Right. I would imagine, and it seems to me that the further that we get away from this horrible chapter in our history, that the stories come more infrequently and fewer and further between. And so when I saw your book, that was the first thought that occurred to me. Wow, I haven't really read any current literature or seen a current, you know, film on the Holocaust. And that was the first thing that came across for me. Have you gotten those kinds of comments as well?
Yeah, I mean, I do think it's scary because there are you know, hardly any survivors left to tell their stories firsthand. But I do, and while I think, you know, mine is its own thing, I do think there are, it's interestingly, more and more third generation survivors trying to go down the same path that I have been down, where there is, I don't know if it's just enough distance or the sense of urgency to tell the stories, but I do feel like there are so many authors out there right now that have this sort of skipped a generation and who are now asking the questions and writing down their family's stories or even just aspects of their family's stories. And I hope that continues. I hope that it doesn't kind of fizzle out. I hope it becomes more important now than ever to keep these stories alive.
That's right. Well, the book is We Were the Lucky Ones. Our guest is Georgia Hunter, and I just have to congratulate you on this tremendous amount of work that you did to put this book together. It's really fantastic. So thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you. That means a lot. I appreciate it.
All right. Take care.
Thank you. You too.
And again, Georgia Hunter. So it's out in paperback, but it was published in 2017. So I'm not sure which month, but it's already a national bestseller. So the really fantastic story, and the story of the story is as interesting, really. Let's thank our underwriters quickly.
Utah Olympic Legacy Foundation, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, San Francisco Design, Park City Mountain, Davidson Orthopedics, Jim Duenley and Mark Wainsgard with retail at New Park, Fairway Independent Mortgage, and Valley Behavioral Health.
And thanks for tuning in to The Mountain Life.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by Long Reimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-Law.com. Fred Marshall Painting, painting Park City's home since 1974, fredmarshallpainting.com, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
You've been listening to KPCW Park City. I'm Lynn Ware-Peak, here with Tim Henney. Time now for NPR News.